This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, Google Play, Reason.com, or wherever you get your podcast on, and rate and review us while you're there. We value your feedback. My guest today is the actor and documentary filmmaker Alex Winter. As an actor, you probably know him best from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventures and the classic goth rock movie Lost Boys. But for the past decade or so, Alex has been creating a series of fascinating documentaries about digital culture and technological innovation. His 2012 doc, Downloaded, looked at the challenge that Napster and unauthorized file sharing had posed to the music industry. In 2015, he released Deep Web, which looked at Bitcoin and the Silk Road website, where people could anonymously buy and sell just about anything they wanted, especially illegal drugs. And now Alex is back with a brand new documentary called Trust Machine, which looks at the promise of blockchain technology that undergirds Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. I'm going to talk to Alex about this new film and some of the issues it raises for the future of the internet and the future of how governments and corporations will seek to control our ability to do whatever we want. Alex, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thanks, Nick. It's good to be on.
Give me the elevator pitch for Trust Machine.
Well, it is essentially a documentary that looks at the mad moment of the blockchain and Bitcoin craze as it hit the wider public over the last 2 years. So it's really about putting our arms around the full weight of all of the issues and hyperbole, hype, scams, legitimacy, financial markets going crazy. It's really a, you know, being a doc, it's really about the people involved in this moment at this time. That's what I really wanted to look at.
One of the really great and entertaining, I mean, it's kind of chilling, but you know, obviously if people who are into Bitcoin, you know, been following it since it emerged in what, early 2009, and they're into Satoshi Nakamoto and they're talking about Bitcoin and everything. But last year or 2 years ago, when Bitcoin really started scaling up in terms of, you know, cracking $20,000 per Bitcoin and all of this, and you have those kind of montages of people on cable news shows and money shows just freaking out. And what was the general response? Were most of the people, I mean, most people in kind of established financial industries, they were trying to write off Bitcoin almost immediately, right?
Yeah, I mean, there was an absolute panic, you know, really almost a radical panic against Bitcoin when it first started to take hold, a little bit later, 2012, 13, post the Silk Road, when Wall Street and, you know, the last film I made was essentially about this, but there was a kind of a nexus point in New York where you had Wall Street and you had, you know, the drug war, and then you had sort of cyber task forces all coming together in their mutual horror and fear that Bitcoin was going to come and create a world of you know, drug madness and people circumventing governments and the collapse of the dollar.
Which is all kind of true, right? Or it's not that it's true, but I mean, part of the utopian vision of Bitcoin is that it takes currency control away from governments, right?
Yeah, I think that part of there were two things at play that fueled the hysteria. Because of course, you know, the motives were true on a certain level. The practical application of Bitcoin is not capable of doing those things at that level, not the level that governments would need to be afraid of it, which is something we got into with Deep Web. And part of the case against Ross Ulbricht, who was in jail for running the Silk Road market. So yes and no. Yes, in the sense that Satoshi's white paper written in 07 absolutely called for a need to circumvent governments and be able to use currencies for, you know, whatever, you know, free citizen would desire. But it, you know, a white paper is not a technology. It's a white paper. And, you know, technologies get, you know, and even Satoshi, whoever that is, created an open source technology that was going to be adopted by a great deal of people with different interests and then adapted into their interests.
So, yeah.
it quickly morphed into many things other than what Satoshi's original vision was.
One of the main themes of the documentary is really how the internet has gone from, maybe it's gone through more than a few of these, but kind of spasms where it's relatively decentralized to relatively centralized. Talk a bit about how that happened and why that is important to this broader kind of Bitcoin and blockchain story.
Because, you know, a lot of the motives for the construction of the internet into something that general citizens could use outside of military and universities and the very rarefied world in which it started was, you know, a lot of those motives were for a more decentralized form of communication and exchange. And we get into that in Trust Machine. I've gotten into that in all the tech docs, because that was when I met Sean Fanning, who invented Napster. I was a big proponent of Napster, not knowing Sean. When I sought him out, finally, one of the things that connected us was I was really taken by the system being more about a decentralized community than about, you know, just stealing music. And it was very much his initial motive was to connect people together in one place in a way that, you know, was free and open. And music was kind of the carrot on the stick that led you into the community. So a lot of the cypherpunks, you know, the groups that were at the heart in the, you know, especially in the 80s and early 90s of building a lot of what we know as the internet and the web today, were very much about, you know, anti-surveillance, having distributed systems that allowed many people to work and build on those systems. So decentralized away from governments, decentralized away from corporations, decentralized away from any kind of organizing system that would prevent people from being able to communicate and exchange freely. And that's, as you guys write about this all the time, as you well know, that is not easy. It's not welcome, and it tends to not exist for, you know, great periods of time. And one of the points we're making in Trust Machine is that the blockchain and cryptocurrency moment we're in is a similar one to the early days of the internet, from the standpoint that, because it's not, you know, we're not dealing with the same scale as the internet right now, but from the standpoint that, you know, there's a lot of hope to use these technologies in ways that are more open and free, and, you know, a fear that they will be co-opted and monopolized the way, you know, the internet was to a great extent.
Well, and we'll come back to, because, I mean, it does seem there's a kind of dynamic that goes on where, and you interview John
Gilmore.
John Gilmore, you know, an early Sun Microsystems employee and a big kind of player in the cypherpunk world, who was talking about the glories of Usenet and you know, a pre-web kind of internet-based way that people could really communicate in all sorts of different weird ways and connect. Then you go through a phase where, I mean, the internet becomes popular partly because of commercial organizations like AOL that make it easy to get online, but then they place certain limits on what you can do. Then they get busted, right? I mean, the one thing we could say is that AOL, whatever else you can say about it, it's been reduced. It's a ruin of its former civilization.
Greatly. Yeah.
And you know, and I say that, I don't know about you, I say that as somebody who one of my early internet accounts was an AOL account, and it was kind of, you know, it helped. It gave me access to something I wouldn't have had otherwise, with all the drawbacks. But so blockchain is this moment, and I think Tim Draper, the venture capitalist, talks about it in the documentary, but other people, that this is blockchain, Bitcoin and blockchain are this moment again where something new and different. There's a kind of temporary autonomous zone going on here where we can do a lot of stuff before, you know, civilization catches up and clamps it down again. What is...
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I was just going to say it is. I just always like to clarify there, a lot of it is more hope than it is practical application.
Right.
So it remains to be seen to what degree it can do that.
Well, let's talk a bit about the relationship between Bitcoin and blockchain, because blockchain is definitely, or rather, Bitcoin is here. And, you know, there's, depending on who you look at, there's as many as 6 million individual kind of users or accounts around the globe. And people are using it. It may not be the ultimate investment for sure, but it seems to be working pretty well as an application. What about blockchain? Like, explain the relationship between blockchain and Bitcoin.
Sure. And I'm going to keep this non-technical because the technical aspects get complicated quickly and also are much better served going to, you know, Google or CoinDesk or one of these places that will give you a much more ironclad example than I will. But, you know, in layman's terms, a blockchain is literally the ledger for something, and in the case of Bitcoin, for the cryptocurrency. So every different cryptocurrency has its own blockchain. So Bitcoin has the Bitcoin blockchain. Ethereum has the Ethereum blockchain. And that is a record of all the transactions on that ledger. So what the reason you hear both being used is, for the most part, and, you know, blockchain, the ledger is mentioned a lot in the white paper, Satoshi's white paper, and even the potential uses for it beyond just currency exchange. So the reason you're hearing about it a lot more is that people began to, because these are open source technologies and because they started to take, people began to innovate and look at ways to use a verifiable distributed ledger that's decentralized, meaning everyone can look at it. Everyone can see all the transactions that are on this ledger at any given moment for different things. Can we use this to help with legal contracts? Can we use this to help with energy systems, solar systems, all the different, a lot of different applications that we get into in the film, where a ledger, a verifiable ledger that's open source and decentralized, meaning one organization doesn't have an ironclad lock on it, can utilize them. It doesn't in any way, I mean, from my perspective and in terms of the story I'm telling, detract from the significance of Bitcoin. Bitcoin is an extremely significant technological moment that has not, despite the volatility in the market of last year, you know, does not appear to be going away, or nor should it be written off. You know, it's an extremely important moment, and, you know, one could easily make, and I don't think there's been a great one yet, a very thorough film just around Bitcoin. But I was particularly interested in exactly what you just described, which is more of a societal thing than a technological thing, which is, who are these people who are interested in decentralization? Why are they interested in it? Why do they think it's important? And what do they think they can do with it, with this technology? That was exactly the story I wanted to tell.
So let's talk about a couple. Yeah, and you know, I agree. I am not a technical person, so I understand Bitcoin conceptually, and I understand the blockchain of the idea of a distributed, incorruptible ledger where everybody within a system shares, has perfect faith in the, you know, that everything that is listed there is true. It will be updated properly. Nobody can cheat. Nobody can gain. You don't need a third party to certify. You don't need the accountant to come in, or the FBI, or, you know, somebody from outside to say, yeah, this is all legit. So now, then people start talking in utopian terms, as we're wont to do, I suppose, as humans, but especially anything that's related to technology. You know, we can do everything to, you know, with the blockchain. The blockchain is going to, you know, solve my back problems. The blockchain is going to end acne. The blockchain is going to, you know, we're going to put everything on the blockchain. And as the movie points out, there's a lot of scams out there where people just kind of say, hey, we're doing blockchain, give us money, and you'll never hear from us again. So it's, you know, there's a lot of, you know, odd stuff going on. But let's talk about some of the specific applications that you go into in the film. One is called the Brooklyn Microgrid. What is that, and how do they use a kind of distributed ledger system to do what they're doing?
Well, here's what's going on. So in different fields, people are trying to see if they can use a distributed ledger to solve certain problems that they have in their fields. So in the area of energy, there are some gigantic companies, including, you know, the UN and other organizations, looking to see if they can help get energy distributed to people who may not have access to it easily or can't afford it. So a ledger, what a microgrid can help you do is, if you could put a box in your house, and this is what the experiment they're doing right now in Brooklyn, though they're doing it, you know, people are doing it in Africa, they're doing it in India, they're doing it all over the world, that keeps a, that is connected to your solar's electrical system. Obviously, all that's always tracking what energy you're using, what energy you're storing and saving, and then you can then you can sell or distribute in any way you want because it's your energy. Portions of that energy to other people using a blockchain type ledger. So it's basically what people are really doing, so that it's understood. And the film is really clear about this. Is they're trying to see if these technologies will help them solve issues that they have. They're trying to build these technologies into innovations they're already doing to try to solve certain problems. But the film, you know, it's actually what the movie is about, is saying that we don't know, you know, what the efficacy is going to be of many of these things. There's an enormous amount of hyperbole. There's an enormous amount of ignorance. Obviously, there's scammers. There's people trying to use this for financial speculation. But it's very intriguing to me who is drawn to decentralized systems, especially as the world we're living in from a technological standpoint and from a government standpoint has gotten so extremely centralized.
Right. So talk about UPort, which is another application of blockchain that you talk about.
Sure. UPort is really interesting to me because what those guys are doing, and again, for the technical background, you can just Google UPort and you get a lot of, read their white paper if you're so inclined. But and I've been dealing with this for years in my own work, which is the area of privacy and your rights to privacy in the digital space, both from a government standpoint and from a corporate standpoint and from a hacker standpoint. It's sort of what I call the three poles of invasion or the three poles of surveillance. And so UPort is looking at sovereign identity applications where you can have a distributed ledger that keeps your identity in the ledger, and the ledger is protected. You know, in current parlance, and I have a quantum physicist talking about this, it has not been hacked. We have not found a way to hack the encryption code that holds these blockchains together. It's not to say that it won't, but
so
we are dealing with very strong math.
When you say your identity, what do you mean? Your social security number, your
everything.
Driver's license?
Yeah. It would be everything, and including, say, you know, as you, I think a really good real world application of this that we show in the film is how UNICEF is using this to tag refugees coming out of war-torn countries, right? So if you've got a refugee coming out of Syria, they often don't even have a passport. So UNICEF will give them a token. A token is a sort of an identifier on the blockchain. And that is going to allow them to have a decentralized but absolutely verifiable record of their identity, who they are, where they were born, where they've traveled to, what jobs they've worked. You know, if they have identification that's given to them by the UN, or if you're a regular citizen, your passport, your driver's license, whatever, so that you have control over that identity record, and that identity record is verifiable. So from a refugee standpoint, you can see how that's useful. From sort of a first world citizen, you can see how that's useful in terms of hackers taking your identities. If a hacker is trying to say, to a credit card company, I am Joe Blow, and you have your information on a verifiable ledger that is, you know, a functional verifiable ledger, you can actually prove that your identity is the verifiable identity as opposed to theirs. And right now, you know, we have Equifax, we have all of these different centralized systems that are pretty Byzantine. And so, again, I'm not an evangelist, so I'm not really that interested in whether or not UPort ends up succeeding as a company or not. No disrespect to them, but I'm interested in the fact that we have these problems that do need to be solved, and whether they're solved by these current technologies or by an evolution of a ledger type technology. There's no doubt in my mind that we're headed towards systems that are also going to need their own protections, both from hackers and governments and corporations. We are headed to new systems that are more digitally based, in order to protect ourselves.
And that's, I mean, something like Equifax or other major databases that store a huge amount of financial information, or it could be medical information, it could be personal information. I mean, we see this all the time where once if a hacker gets into that system, their kids in a candy store. So this allows each of us to carry our own kind of information. But then, I get that conceptually, but then how do you share that with people in a way that they're not like, okay, I'm going to need that and your driver's license?
Well, ultimately, that's going to, I mean, it gets a little into the granular details of how these, which company is actually going to survive, will be the one that can do that in a way that's most efficient, which is very similar to what happened with Bitcoin, where there are efficiencies with Bitcoin and there are horrible inefficiencies with Bitcoin, you know, such as the enormous amount of energy that it requires in order to function and to evolve. You could go and look at Uport, but there's different, people have different systems. Some people have a mobile app. But again, it's tied to a password that is ironclad that connects to an ironclad verifiable ledger. So it's, you know, each, your access point is going to be via, you know, some kind of password or some kind of encrypted code that is verifiable. And that's not uncommon nowadays. And, you know, in terms of even end-to-end encryption, say if you are using Signal, or in the old days when we used PGP email, you know, if you have a key and someone else has a key, and you can send them something that's encrypted, that is verifiable. I mean, it really is fairly ironclad verifiable. It's used by very high-end, you know, people in the Defense Department who need to protect identity. So there are very clean, easy ways to present your identity, you know, by way of this ledger that, or a ledger that is not the same as handing over a credit card. I mean, look at what's happening. They're phasing out signatures on credit cards now because they're meaningless as a form of ID.
So I can't remember the last time I signed my name on a credit card. I just swipe a line.
Yeah, I know. And when you do, it's weird. You sort of feel like you're being catapulted back into the 90s, but things are changing. And, you know, there is an enormous amount of, people get scared when things are going to change, and they can, you know, they can either impose very egregious laws to try to stop people from evolving, or they can just be very reactionary and hostile. I think we're seeing both of those things.
So speaking of obviously downloaded, and, you know, the music industry lost its shit over Napster before effectively embracing, you know, a variation on it, 10 or 15 years later. Grammatic is a DJ who is a figure in your movie that's kind of interesting. And what did he do? And how was he embracing a different model of kind of getting paid for music and also paying back his fans for being into his music?
It's interesting. And you can, again, you can go to his website and look into the details of this. But what he did was he, what's called, tokenized himself, meaning he created a token on the Ethereum blockchain, I believe. I don't think I'm wrong about that. It's been a little while since I've actually made the film, so I'm trying to remember all the details. But he made he tokenized himself, and he created his own token on the blockchain that allows his fans to invest in his brand. So in a way, it's an experiment, and he's very open about this. That you know, it's early days in terms of whether it'll be able to work. The motive for it, what artists who are doing this are looking to do, is to create a verifiable, again, a verifiable ledger of them and their work that can directly, because this is a decentralized space where you can directly connect to your fans. So, whoa, did I lose you?
No, I'm here.
Where your fans can give you money and get, in whatever form, you know, digital currency, cryptocurrency, or regular money, however, get your work. You are having a direct relationship with that fan base. It's basically, you almost end up with a decentralized distribution network. And, you know, it's early, so it's going to take some infrastructure building. But what artists like Grammatic and Imogen Heap are looking to do, which is desperately needed, and I've been dealing with this since Downloaded, is to start to veer towards a system that is not so Byzantine or unfair as the pre-existing system for recording artists, film artists, you know, writers, where you can directly engage with your fans, where fans can pay you, you know, micro payments, just get a song, or they can, as Imogen talks about, they set up a system where you could pay towards so much of your this money is going towards your song, the rest is going to a charity organization that is being run through this organization or this blockchain-based token. So it's really a way for people to try to examine how these technologies can lead us into more equitable and more less onerous systems moving forward, and less Byzantine systems, because publishing is a mess. Copyright is a mess. We're dealing with legal systems that are totally ill-equipped to deal with the world that we live in today.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting because Grammatic put all of his stuff on Pirate Bay, the BitTorrent site, and now I guess is engaging more directly with its fans. Is blockchain itself necessary for this? Or, I mean, it seems a little bit, you know, there was Patronet and there were a couple of other early versions of this where, you know, once you can have a kind of direct conversation with an artist or with a site. I mean, I guess for me, that's one of the questions here is that is, you know, blockchain, which seems to be fundamental to Bitcoin, because you want to get rid of, you don't want that third party where you need a trusted third party to verify something. But in some of this, it seems more like an iteration up from kind of crowdfunding or kind of direct payment to artists that you saw in the late 90s.
I think that what's going on is that people are trying to see if, I think, you know, most people inside the blockchain space who are serious and not to be dismissed, would tell you not to think about it from the standpoint of the word blockchain, which I think is really fair. I think that people's brains start to melt if you get too technical. Mm-hmm. And so blockchain has become kind of a buzzword or a catch-all for this idea of decentralized distributed systems that people are trying to innovate towards right now. I think that, to be fair to the cryptography community, I think it's a large, you know, bug in their butt about the co-opting of the word crypto away from cryptography and the sort of notion, as you just said, of blockchain being bandied about as this thing that's going to solve everything. I mean, no one who I've met in this space who is serious thinks that's true. Right. Or would even talk in those terms. It's kind of a way of not dumbing it down, but simplifying what can be a really complex and very broad set of innovations into something, you know, not entirely accurate, but at least understandable. So, you know, I would say yes and no. I'm a bit more of a believer than people say that that these systems are being used to solve problems that don't exist or that they're not the right systems. I do think trying to work towards, you know, an inherently decentralized, distributed, and verifiable ledger or system would be very useful for legal contracts, would be very useful potentially for setting up publishing and payment systems that are not so Byzantine, that are more easily organized and overseen. And honestly, Nick, it gets kind of unsexy once you drill down into it. It gets kind of boring, and it really does. It's fairly bureaucratic. That's why, you know, there's so many scammers, because if you've got rappers talking about, you know, changing the world with blockchain, you know it's BS. You know, the truth about what's going on is actually fairly mundane and bureaucratic. And also, you know, as you well know, this notion of a pure decentralization is unattainable and would not even be something you'd want. I mean, so even that is, you know, because people will argue and say, well, none of these are wholly decentralized. Well, you don't really want them to be wholly decentralized. The point more is that the average person needs to have more access to their own records, to their own identity, to their own content, to their own ability to exchange. It doesn't mean that there can't be some kind of bureaucratic oversight that helps us function properly. What we don't want is monopolies and government lockdowns that end up preventing us from being able to have effective systems. That's really what people are talking about.
Yeah. So, Tuck, this the final example I ask you to explain, which goes right to this, is a group called RightMesh, and they're trying to essentially create an internet that doesn't have ISPs. How does that work?
Well, the RightMesh specifically is talking about using your cell. Cell communication. So it avoids, it basically creates the equivalent of an ISP network without an ISP. So it would, you know, it connects up to pre-existing networks that are used for different types of signals. And people who are invested in mesh technology, which is worth investigating, it's extremely interesting, are looking for all kinds of ways to do that that don't necessarily even require, you know, cell towers and the like. But the point is that we've gotten accustomed to communicating via what we call the internet, you know, through ISP systems with that oversight. And of course, that leads to monopolies and control. Mm-hmm. You look at the net neutrality battle that's been going on for ages here, which I don't think you could easily get anyone to explain to you clearly anymore. It's gotten so muddied up in the last, you know, decade or so. But there's a lot of concern around, you know, will you get throttled? Will you will you just be lied to and controlled by these corporations? So there's a desire to create network systems that are outside of you know, internet service providers' control, or even, you know, outside of a technological reliance on those systems, including concerns about, you know, hackers, state hackers getting into electric grids and other forms of cyber terrorism, ways that would allow us to have networks and systems that aren't reliant on, you know, those kinds of systems that are fairly easily penetrated.
So to the extent that your documentary has Trust Machine has a protagonist, it's a UK hacker named Larry Love. What is his story, and why is it in there? Because it's not, you know, and again, I realize you're talking about something broader than blockchain, or it's kind of conceptual, this idea of dispersion and decentralization and empowerment of individual users. Talk, you know, give the thumbnail sketch of Larry Love.
Well, Larry is a computer scientist, a hacker, who absolutely is in the blockchain innovation field. That's where he resides. But he is not, you know, he's young, you know, and he was being charged by the U.S. government. And then there was an attempt for several years, over 3 years, to extradite him to the United States, where he could have served as, you know, as much as 99 years in prison. Now, they never revealed to him the full details of the charges. Those were kept undisclosed. But the hacking charges involved a protest that was conducted mostly by the organization Anonymous against the suicide of Aaron Swartz. And Aaron was a very brilliant young computer scientist and political activist, large part to do with the Move On organization and a lot of other anti-corruption advocacy organizations, who was also being over-prosecuted by the U.S. government and ended up hanging himself over that. So Anonymous broke into the DOJ website, several websites, government websites, and posted Games of Asteroids and other forms of protest to Aaron's death. And, you know, some of this was Larry was being accused for being behind, which no evidence had been brought forward to that. But that was what the charge was primarily. So it was a hacking government websites and computer systems, and the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the CFAA, which is a very egregious law and completely outdated, was being used as a way to shackle him. Right. So to me, it was a really important story because, as I said, my entire motivation to make this movie was really not about trumpeting blockchain companies, but about talking about this moment we're in, where there seems to be such a great desire for innovative, decentralized forms of communication and systems moving forward that can get us around the sort of yoke of government malfeasance and corporate malfeasance. And Lowry to me really represents, I don't think he would identify as a cypherpunk, but he to me represents the modern day cypherpunk. So the film basically opens and closes with John Gilmore, the original cypherpunk, and Lowry I would call the current day cypherpunk, and it ends with them because, you know, and I've said this before, and a lot of people don't like it, but the, you know, the origins of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency and blockchain are inescapably political. They are. It's, if you look at the white papers for any of these things, if you look at the white papers and the values of the cyberpunks in the early days of the internet, they were absolutely political. They were anti-surveillance. They were pro-privacy. They were pro, you know, the freedom of individual to be able to communicate freely. And so I thought it was very, very important to drill down into the motives. Where did these things come from in the first place, as opposed to do what everyone else does, which is just vault over all that and go directly to Wall Street, go directly to Silicon Valley, go directly to these places that adopted these technologies. But it's absolutely not where they came from originally.
How would you define your politics, or do you have a politics?
Yeah, you know, I don't really define myself politically. I do have very diehard specific political values. You know, I am very opposed to government surveillance. I'm very opposed to corporate surveillance. I do very much believe in the rights of the individual. I do think we need laws. I do think we need taxes and infrastructure. I do, absolutely. But I do also feel that there is, I would, you know, call myself a radical reformer in terms of the people that I follow and the politics that I follow. I think that citizens have to be very, very, very engaged, or their lives will be dictated to them very quickly. And we see it over and over again.
Well, that seems to be a recurring theme in your work, that in the documentaries, where a new form of technology comes along. And you have a great quote, actually, for Vladimir Putin, of all people, where he says that, I'm going to read it, that the Stone Age ended not because of a lack of stones, but because new technologies appeared. That's like the scoreboard for Putin. That's a pretty good quote. But technology comes along, it disrupts things, and then people overreact. But then they kind of end up adopting some version of the thing that they were trying to squash. Is that a fair assessment of, you know, when you think about something like downloaded or deep web? Or this, I guess.
I think it's absolutely the case. And I think that when you stick your neck out of the foxhole, you know, of wherever civilization happens to be at the time, you know, they're going to throw rocks at you. Yeah. And it's absolutely happening in this moment. You know, the nuance just goes out the window. You know, you can look at the people that are in this space that are trying to find ways to move, to solve problems and move forward with these technologies. Mm-hmm. And you can scorn them, because there are scammers and there are unproven aspects to them, and there are things that are going to, there are bad things about them, like how much energy they use. But, you know, if you're a grounded, you know, reasoned person, you're going to sit back and know that some of these people are smarter than you are, and the problems are real, and let's see if we can solve them. And it's funny, because with Napster, you know, it didn't strike me as a grave situation. It struck me as an important technology. It was important to put 100 million people together from around the world in a decentralized space. It was a central server, but there was nobody governing that space. That was really significant. But I understood at the time that it wasn't a life or death thing. You know, stakes get high as you move along. I think the stakes in the information age are getting higher and higher. So I think that we have more need to be nuanced today, not less. And unfortunately, we see less, I think. Hmm.
What is there a way? I mean, I guess your movies are one way to, you know, I think a lot about Ross Ulbricht, the founder and the person who is effectively has a life sentence for founding Silk Road. I mean, do we really think that there isn't, you know, Silk Road is not just in the way that kind of Napster eventually gives rise to Spotify? Silk Road is going to give rise to a system that is, you know, validated by the major industry players and the political players while Ross Ulbricht rots in jail. Is there a way to kind of, you know, tamp down the overreaction before people actually get put in jail or, you know, get hurt in a big way?
I think there is, you know, and I think that it's sort of you know, what I look at as a filmmaker, and you know, I like to make movies that are entertaining and are telling an interesting story, but, you know, I'm certainly looking at what can I, you know, what little thing can each one of us do, right? And I think, like, what I can do is I can try to help inform people. You know, my films tend to be about the gray spaces specifically. Mm-hmm. They don't actually attempt to take sides in the blockchain argument. I'm not even sure what side I'm on because it's so early. I think it's too early to say what these things are going to do. But I think you can present the grays. A lot of people may throw rocks at the grays. They may throw rocks at your movie. But you do. I think you do start to make little cracks in that dam. And I think each person can do that in their own way. But I do think it's about knowledge. I think it's about knowledge. I know that, you know, there's a lot of talk about fake news, but you know, the reality of it is if you're, you know, halfway intelligent and you're willing to give a little bit of effort, it doesn't take very long to ferret out the false from the true. It doesn't. So, you know, for me with the films, I really just try to present the grays and the nuanced kind of arguments or use cases or whatever, so that people can get a sense of what's actually happening in these spaces, as opposed to the hyperbole they'll tend to get, or just an overload of information that they can't parse.
What is the what's the best way to watch Trust Machine?
Well, Trust Machine is going to be it has a very small theatrical run right now, sort of in lead up. It's going to be coming out on a brand new streaming and VOD platform in March. I don't know if it even has a name yet. It's coming from Singular DTV, which is actually a blockchain-backed or blockchain-based company that's trying to solve some of the media problems in the current climate for artists. It'll be everywhere. It'll be Amazon, iTunes, all of that.
Okay, and I was going to say, I mean, you mentioned the Byzantine nature of payments and whatnot. That is, you know, particularly in creative spaces, the large companies have so much control, right, over... You know, how many books did you sell? When do you get paid? Do you get paid records, et cetera? So this, I assume Singular D is an attempt to kind of streamline that and make it. What's the opposite of Byzantine? I don't know.
A simple, efficient system that
right.
is a clear way for rights to be tracked, for the artist to have more control over their product, for them to be able to get it more directly to the audience. It doesn't mean you don't need marketers and studios and all of that stuff all needs to happen. The copyright law is very old and creaky, and rights, especially, you know, now we live in a global society, you know, dealing with rights issues, like from the US, then to Canada, then to overseas, then to TV, then to VOD, then to streaming. It's insane. And it's almost impossible to keep track of. So, you know, certainly we need better systems that are, you know, digitally based moving forward. So some of these companies like that company, like Singular, are trying to figure out ways to do that. And it's super early, which they would all admit. They're all, you know, down in the lab trying to figure it out.
Well, we will leave it there. Thank you so much for Trust Machine. I've been talking with Alex Winter. He's the director most recently of the documentary Trust Machine, which is about blockchain technology and Bitcoin and a search for a decentralized, dispersed, empowering way of getting about your business and your culture in the world today. Alex, thanks for talking to Reason.
Yeah, always. I appreciate you having me.
This has been the Reason Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, at Google Play, Reason, or wherever you want, and rate and review us while you're there. Thanks for listening.